A group from Angelo State here today, and Barbara Cook is their leader, and we're glad to have you for a portion of our argument. Court is ready to hear arguments from petitioner in the cause of Commercial Life Insurance Company versus Texas State Board of Insurance and others.
May I please report? I am Hector Davion with the law firm of Davion, Bodies and Richards. With me at council table is James P. Wallace, co-counsel on behalf of petitioner this morning. Judge Wallace was also the principal author of the brief which is before the court. The matter comes to court on writ of error and the Austin Court of Appeals. The point of error is that the Court of Appeals erred in sustaining the trial court in granting the plea of the jurisdiction filed by respondents, three insurance companies. The plea of the jurisdiction was filed on the basis that the motion for rehearing with respect to the board order, the insurance board order, was filed on the 17th day rather than within the 15 days set out in Section 15 of the Texas Registered Administrative Procedures Act. The facts that are really critical to an analysis of this matter are really three facts. The first fact is that the State Board of Insurance entered an order on January 29, 1985. The second fact is that the State Board of Insurance failed to give notice to the affected party or counsel for the affected party. Third fact is that petitioner, upon becoming aware, having actual notice of the entry of the order on February 15, 1985, filed a motion for rehearing with respect to the board order. Those are the three facts. The issue then before the court is, in light of those facts, was the sustaining of the trial court's granting of the plea of the jurisdiction proper? An analysis of that necessarily involves an analysis of Section 16 of the Texas Registered Administrative Procedures Act and an analysis of the board's own rules relative to that matter. Paragraph B of Section 16 has two sentences that have been cited time and again in this matter. They are the last two sentences of that section. The first of the last sentences is this: parties shall be notified either personally or by mail of any decision or order. Responsibility number one. State agency is required under Section 16 to provide notice of a decision or order. No time limit, just a requirement that notice be given. The second sentence, the last sentence, reads, on written request, a copy of the decision or order shall be delivered or mailed to any party and to his attorney of record. The significance for having cited that last sentence is an argument is made by a respondent that since petitioner did not make the written request for the order, then that's petitioner's problem and therefore the plea of the jurisdiction is properly granted. The difficulty I have with that particular argument is that there is nothing in the sentence that I just read to the court that says that if I file a written request for a copy of the decision or order, the state agency is required to give me that decision or order within the 15 days. It simply says that they have a responsibility to provide a copy of the written decision or order. That's all it says. Then in looking at paragraph E, which is the paragraph that sets out the 15-day requirement, it says that a motion for rehearing must be filed within 15 days after the date of rendition of a final decision or order. That sentence in and of itself would certainly present difficulty to any jurist. The word must is included. But this court has held, it has been held by the courts of this state that the word must in the Texas Registered Administrative Procedures Act is directory rather than mandatory with respect to the entry of decision within 60 days from the date of closing of the record. So I think that there's precedent for holding that the word must is not necessarily mandatory at all. However, The Austin Court of Appeals has ruled in Leisure Services versus the Texas Catastrophe Property Insurance Association that the sentence that I just quoted to you means that that is mandatory and jurisdictional, the 15-day requirement. And even if a party fails to receive notice, in dicta, the courts made that statement, then the affected party had a responsibility anyway to file a motion for a hearing within 15 days, even without being provided notice. I have a little trouble with that. In terms of just what I call the fairness doctrine. It just can't say it.
Counsel, yes. What in your opinion is the purpose of notice?
The purpose of notice of the entry of the order?
Yes.
The purpose of notice of the entry of the order, in my opinion, is to permit the party, the affected party, to avail themselves of the rights set out in all of Section 16 of the Administrative Procedures Act. That is to say, the responsibility of the state agency is to give notice. The purpose of that notice is so that the party knows an order has been entered. And as was pointed out in the brief, if we want a copy of the order so that we can file a motion for review for whatever purpose, we can ask for it if it wasn't provided to us. But if we don't get that notice within the 15 days, what's the purpose of requiring the notice at all? Why even say that we should be given notice? If we aren't required, if the state agency is not required to provide that notice within the 15-day limitation set out in paragraph E, it just doesn't make any sense. But that sentence doesn't stand alone, Justice Cook. It goes on. The paragraph goes on. The paragraph goes on to say that the agency may, by written order, extend the period of time for filing the motions and replies and taking agency action, except that an extension may not extend the period for agency action beyond 90 days after the date of rendition of the final decision or order. Now, that's a sentence that frankly hasn't been raised by anybody. But it's a sentence that's here. It's a sentence that's been in the law from the get-go. It's not a new sentence. That sentence says to me that the word must is directory by statute. It's not mandatory because it says that the agency may extend the time period. If the time period may be extended, the time period it has reference to is the 15 days, among others, then clearly it becomes directory. And I submit to the court that that is exactly what the State Board of Insurance did by order in adopting its rules of practice and procedure. By order, it adopted Rule 1.28, which has been cited time and again at the trial court level, at the Court of Appeals level, and now here today, I'll cite it to you again. And when the Insurance Board adopted by order 1.28, it said that deposit in the United States mail of a registered or a certified letter returned receipt requested containing a notice of a hearing in compliance with the requirements specified by this rule, or containing a copy of any decision or order addressed to the affected party or the attorney of record for the party sent to the party's last known address or the attorney's last known address shall constitute notice of the hearing. I think what the board did there was to interpret the sentence in paragraph B of section 16 that says you have to give notice. There the insurance board said, here is how we will give notice. We will give notice by depositing in the U.S. mail's return receipt requested a copy of the decision or order. That's what they did in this rule, number one. Number two, they went on to say, the date of deposit as here and above provided is the date of the act after which any designated period of time begins to run. The board, by order, in adopting these rules, modified the 15-day period set out in paragraph E. But let's presume for a moment that they did. Is it fair? Is it reasonable to say that a party litigant can control access to the appellate court by simply withholding notice? Is that a result that expresses rudiments of fair play, as is required under Murphy v. Rowland at 609 Southwest 2nd 292. That's the administrative law standard. Voters, fair play. And further, I think the court's decision, Doctors Hospital Facilities versus Fifth Court of Appeals, cited at 750 Southwest 2nd 177, really speaks volumes about this case. That case dealt with various motions for rehearing filed at the Civil Court of Appeals level and the writ of error filed here. But in writing for the court, Justice Wallace stated at page 178 that the right to file a motion for rehearing would be without any value whatsoever if the court had no duty to act upon it. Modifying that sentence, I think, fits very nicely with the case here today. The right to file a motion for rehearing would be without any value whatsoever if the other party to the litigation could defeat the effect of that motion for rehearing by withholding notice beyond the 15 days. Beyond that, Justice Wallace wrote at page 179, however, justice is not served by a rule that allows one litigant to deprive the other of the right to invoke the appellate jurisdiction of this court merely by invoking it first. The sentence could read here today, moreover, justice is not served by a rule that allows one litigant to deprive the other of the right to invoke the appellate jurisdiction of this court merely by withholding notice beyond 15 days. At page 179, Justice Wallace went on to write, the right of access to an appellate tribunal is a valuable one, constitutionally protected against arbitrary or unreasonable abrogation. And I submit to this court that it's arbitrary, it's unreasonable to state that an affected party has an obligation to file a motion for rehearing within 15 days. However, the other party, the one that rendered the act, has no obligation to provide notice within the 15 days.
If the agency's failure to give notice of its decision affects the party's obligation to file a motion within 15 days, when does the motion have to be filed?
When does the motion have to be filed?
Yes.
I submit to the court that the motion should have been filed, first of all, either in accordance with the board rules, 15 days from the date of deposit in the U.S. mail, which apparently wasn't done in this case, or 15 days from what can be shown through evidence of actual notice of that order. I'm not saying that the time period never runs. I'm just saying that fairness dictates a reasonable standard that permits parties access to the appellate courts, to the right of appeal. The right of appeal is set out in the Texas Register and Administrative Procedures Act. The right of appeal is set out in Chapter 1 of the Texas Insurance Code.
Under the board's rules, if it's lost in the mail.
Sir?
Under the board's rules, if it's lost in the mail, problem of the applicant.
Under the board's rules, it is the problem of the applicant, yes, sir.
If Judge Lowry and the Court of Appeals were correct, and you're incorrect on these matters, is there anything to prevent your client from going back and re-presenting its case to the Board of Insurance in a new proceeding? Practical effect.
Yes, Your Honor. There is a practical effect. This matter involves a protest to the use of a name. That's what this is all about. My client was formerly National Ben Franklin Life Insurance Company, licensed to do business in 49 states, part of a corporate program name change. They applied to have their name changed here in this state, along with every other state, to commercial life insurance company. Application was granted by the Commissioner of Insurance. That action resolved that matter. We secured our certificate of authority under the new name. The respondent companies filed an appeal to the State Board of Insurance. State Board of Insurance held their hearing. They rendered their order, and they decided finally what they intend to do about it. And that is to reverse the Commissioner of Insurance and not permit the use of the name. And I think the State Board of Insurance would take the position we've already spoken. We've already said you can't use the name. It's determined you have a right of appeal. If you want to reverse it, that's your right. But our decision is staying. And that's how they're prejudiced. They've already been through that from you. They've already had the decision rendered. They've already used it. They've already gone through the mechanisms that are available to them through administrative remedy. They've exhausted that remedy. And they simply want to go ahead and pursue the remedy that provided to them at Chapter 1 of the Texas Insurance Code and in the Texas Registered Administrative Procedure Act, the right of appeal to court on that issue. But I think the answer to your question, just as dogged, is that I think it would be a fruitless exercise to attempt to reopen the matter before the State Board of Insurance, and I don't know of a mechanism that is available to do that anyway.
Since even under the State Board of Insurance, given your answer to my prior question, the burden of something being lost in the mail is on the applicant. Does the applicant under the State Board rules or under the Administrative Procedure Act have any responsibility to monitor the agency to determine whether its decisions have been rendered or not?
Well, I think that you could certainly say they have some responsibility to monitor, but in this situation, the facts are that the appeal was taken in 1984 to the board. Originally set for hearing January of 1984. Notice was sent out, certified mail, returned to seek requested of that particular set. It was reset two different times after that. The record shows that in each and every one of those occasions, notice was sent out, certified mail, returned to seek requested for the reset. Finally, in July, the matter was heard. After that, the board sent out no notice by certified mail return receipt request to the affected parties that there would be a meeting of the board, and there was a meeting of the board in November of 1984. Hearings closed in July. Nothing else happened until November of 1984. The board publishes notice of its meeting in the Texas Register, which is notice to the world, and certainly counsel for respondent will argue, well, you got your notice. The Texas Register told you of their meeting, but no notice was sent out by certified mail return receipt request. In this contested case matter of that meeting, the board at that meeting announced their decision to reverse the Commissioner of Insurance, but no order came down. Nothing happened between November 7th, I believe it's the date of 1985, until January 29th of 1986. How much monitoring could have been done by petitioner to keep track of the gap between July and November and November and January to find out if the State Board of Insurance had entered its order?
Sounds to me that somebody was going out of their way to hide the ball.
Well, Your Honor, we're certainly not alleging that, and that's not what we believe. All we want is our day in court, and we believe that fairness dictates that we have it by a reasonable interpretation of Section 16. One that grants us fair play. That's all we want, fair play. And fair play does not mean that you take a convoluted, strict interpretation of paragraph E simply to defeat jurisdiction. That is not what administrative law is about. Indeed, I don't think that's what the law is about, period. That's all we're asking. To reverse the Court of Appeals on that point, a reasonable interpretation of paragraph E in light of the Board of Rules, in light of the total reading of Section 16. Fair.
And you go back to the Court of Appeals for what?
Not to go back to the Court of Appeals, simply reverse the Court of Appeals, go back to the trial court for hearing on the merits of the appeal. Trial on the merits. Under the Texas Insurance Code, we're entitled to trial de novo on the merits. And that's what we want. That's what we're asking this court. And as I was told when I first got out of law school, you need to be quick, accurate, and gone. And unless there are any other questions, thank the court.
That hasn't changed, by the way, since you got out of law school.
Some people don't agree to that.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Devin McCallum will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court. My name is Dudley McCullough, Austin Firm of Keith Davis McCullough, and I'm here representing three insurance companies who are opposed to the the use of the name that the petitioner now tells this court has been using, even though the State Board of Insurance entered a final order denying it the use of that name in this state. I'll try to be quick, and ultimately I'll be gone. But at the outset, I would address the issue of accuracy. And I would turn to several of the statements and the facts recited in the brief filed by petitioners in this case. First of all, they recited that pursuant to the order of the Commissioner of Insurance, is simply an intermediary. They commenced doing business and continue to do so. They have been admitted to do business in the state of Texas since 1900. This is not any new venture that they endeavor to begin after the Commissioner's order. Secondly, on that same page 2 of their application, they recite the open meeting that was held pursuant to notice in the Texas Register on November 7, 1984, and then they say no decision was announced on that date. And I heard Mr. DeLeon take it to correct that. The order that is in evidence in this case recites very clearly that the State Board of Insurance voted in open meeting on November 7, 1984 and reversed the order of the Commissioner of Insurance that gave them temporary, but not lasting, permission to use that name. And there is not one stick of evidence in this record, not one line of testimony, that the petitioners were not fully aware of. In fact, may have even been present at the meeting of November 7, 1984, and were fully aware of the decision of the State Board of Insurance.
Let me just tell you what's troubling me. I get the impression from what little I know about the case that there's a state agency here, after having been in this contested case given certified mail returners who requested notices of passing the case or postponements and whatnot, when they entered the order, didn't follow that procedure. And you're asking us to sanction a situation where a state agency makes an order and does not give prompt notice to the decision. Is that what you're asking us to do?
No, sir, not at all. Not since the question included proper notice. But the question is in two parts, and let me address it. The plaintiffs, or in particular, made, for some reason, a great deal of effort in establishing that, as far as notice of a hearing was concerned, the State Board of Insurance sent out notice of the hearing by certified mail. That has to do with a hearing, which cannot be conducted at the level, at the administrative level, and in accordance with due process of law, without proper notice. So the fact that the State Board of Insurance or any other agency chooses to give notice of the hearing by certified mail or any other process has nothing to do with Section 16B.
We have notice of a hearing of contested matter.
That is correct. The parties show up, they present their evidence, they argue their case, and then that matters.
Why does it not follow that in due fairness to the litigants, that when the board makes the decision to notify the party?
Because the statutory scheme enacted by the legislature in Section 16 says that if the wording clearly, and it is our position that that last sentence of Section 16B, which was never mentioned by the plaintiffs until today, puts the onus on them. If you want to know and want to have a copy of that order from which you can file a motion for rehearing, written request, and the word written was put in by the Texas legislature to put the burden on them to make that request to the agency so that the agency is then on notice that these people want a copy of that order and they'll file their motion.
That's for getting a copy of the order. But what's the issue here is whether or not the existence of the order, the signing of the order, needs to be notified.
I recognize.
And I haven't heard you address that yet.
Well, I address it by saying that the notice of an order does not let you file a motion for rehearing at all.
We're not talking about motions for rehearing. We're talking about getting notice of the action of the commission so that they can or can't or won't file a motion for rehearing. It's their option after that. Just getting notice of the action that's taken is what we're talking about, isn't it?
Well, that's what you're talking about in response to their argument. And I recognize the argument. I am saying to you that the entire thrust of the statute was, first of all, that that first sentence is directory only. It's not mandatory. If it is mandatory, every agency in this state is going to have some new legislation written for it by this court, and they will then be required to apparently call them on the phone, send them by mail, or as we'll get to in a minute, send it by registered or certified mail.
Gosh, I didn't know that didn't already happen.
It doesn't happen. It does not happen at all. And I mean, it's just...
And you're saying the statute doesn't require it?
Not at all. No, no more than it requires in a mandatory fashion that the final decision be rendered in 60 days. And then, of course, the Court of Appeals has held twice that the complete failure to send them an order or to notify of an order does not invalidate the order. The legislature didn't say the failure to do so invalidates it or any subsequent action.
Well, some of these agency decisions are fairly important. So does it strike you as fair that they should be able to ambush the parties that are appearing before them by making decisions and not sending them notice that they're being made?
Not if it's been requested. I don't charge the agencies with ambush. I am saying that the purpose of this statute was to require the practitioners before them to make some effort to learn of the order.
You wouldn't feel somewhat upset if you heard about a decision in a lawsuit that you were trying 60 days after the judgment had been signed by reading the newspaper?
It's never happened, so I don't know how I would feel. I make it a practice to find out about judgments in my lawsuits and orders before agencies before which I practice.
Counsel.
And that's the way people who practice in the newspaper.
What do you do? Call every week? Your secretary has a particular file of all pending?
I do. Same way I check on orders at this court if I have a matter before.
Counsel, even if I request or anyone requests it, it doesn't say when they have to send it.
It does not. I understand.
So they can mail it on the 14th day. So that even if I'm in good faith trying to monitor it, I still don't get it until after the correct time.
I don't agree with that. And I can't agree with it because of the familiarity with the history of the act and the way the language is structured. The actual practice.
It doesn't say shall promptly mail, shall forthwith mail.
That's right. It does not.
So what safeguards do I have by requesting that I receive a copy?
It is our position that if you submit written requests for a copy of that order and the agency delays, it comes out and they unduly delay or they don't get it to you, then I think that you have a conscious refusal by the agency to comply with your request, and I think you have grounds to complain.
That's a complaint in the district court. That's up to the district court to make this implied exception.
The way Section 16B, it doesn't say anything about a request to be informed of the existence of the order. It's the request to get a copy of the order.
I'm familiar with the word.
Well, but the first sentence, you keep mixing the two up, it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong.
I'm trying to talk about them both.
I know. I know you're trying to talk about them in the same breath, but it doesn't say anything about notification shall be upon written request. It says, if you want a copy of the decision, you file a written request. The sentence that requires notice is very simple. It just says, parties shall be notified either personally or by mail of any decision or order, period.
If that's mandatory,
and if you want a copy of it, then you got to ask for it.
If that's mandatory, then the agency, like I say...
And you don't think it should be mandatory?
I do not think it is mandatory. The question of whether it should be or not is up to the legislature, and they could have made it so.
Well, it's kind of up to us, isn't it?
It certainly can be.
But the word's pretty plain.
Of course, you know,
I can't quote my Latin very well, but when it says something, it means that what it says.
Far be it for me to dispute the power of the legislature or this court to write statutes.
Under that statute, eventually notice has to be given.
Sometimes.
So every 5 or 10 years, an agency would have to go back and, at the time it purges its records, give notice, say, to be in compliance with this statute.
I don't think that they would have to do it every 5 or 10 years.
Well, every 100 years, then. At some point, you have to give it.
They have to do it every 100.
When do they give the notice?
Different agencies do it different ways. Some do it immediately, some do it later. The practice is varied as there are agencies.
And what is it you're proposing when we do?
I'm proposing that when...
How are you proposing we read this language, that parties shall be notified either personally or by mail of any decision or order?
I'm proposing you read that as the courts of appeals have done, as directory. Same way this court has read the 60-day requirement for entry of a final decision.
You wouldn't have any objection if we held a directory and said it's up to the agency as to when to notify them, and then have the 15 days run from the date of the mailing, would you?
Would I have any objection?
No problem with it.
Well, yes, I have a problem with it because you're doing a total rewrite on the statute. It doesn't say that it has to be by mail. And if I can get around to a minute to talk about the rules of the agency and the way they construe them and then don't construe them, we'll see that totally different results at least under their interpretation. But as you read the first sentence, as I read it, it doesn't say it has to be by mail.
Or personal. It says by mail or personal.
Right. So, contrary to Justice Spears, he says he's going to start 15 days from the date of mailing. But if the agency contacts him personally and says, hey, this order's been entered, I don't know when you want the 15 days to run.
I think it should run from the date that it's mailed or personally notified. And forgive my error in framing the question. You seized upon it very skillfully. All I'm asking you is, shouldn't the 15 days start to run under that sentence from when that notice is given, however it's given?
Well, it depends on how it's given, and that's my point. Rule 306A of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure has a very elaborate scheme for the district clerk to mail out notices of judgment. And the time starts to run. The only way somebody defeats that by not filing in time is if they show up in court and present proof and evidence, hard evidence that they didn't get it or they weren't aware of it. And none of that happened here. So I'm just saying that the legislature could have written such a scheme in this statute. It didn't. What they did write is clear to those of us who practice before agency. These people never took the very simple step that the legislature established to ensure, or at least endeavor to ensure, that they were aware of the content of the board order.
Counsel, you had said earlier that if the agency sent out notice on the 14th day, that the person would probably have a remedy.
When, in response to a written request.
Yes, in response to a written request. Now, when, in your opinion, would a person, would they have a remedy if they put it in the mail on the 13th day or the 12th day?
I cannot call that shot with exact precision, and the legislature didn't, and so we are left to talk about, I suppose, a reasonable time, if that first step is everything.
But isn't it really a fairness issue?
If it's couched that way, sure, I think it's a fairness issue. I think it's fair for people who practice before agencies to find out when orders are entered. If the legislature had felt it was fair to require, as a prerequisite, that something be done or given within a particular period of time, or to use the elaborate scheme that's used in the rules of civil procedure, that's a totally another matter. I'm certainly in favor of fair legislative act. I believe that 16B as written, and as we construe it, and as it's been construed by the Court of Appeals, is a fair set. And as a result, in this case, is fair, for a lot of the reasons I may talk about in a minute.
So why don't you move on to your other arguments?
Thank you. As I said, the petitioner has not contended, nor produced any evidence that it was unaware of the board's vote taken on this matter, and that's all that notification of the entry of an order would get them in this matter that was taken in November of 1984. In another part of the brief, they say that the evidence, it is the practice of the board to send such notice in all cases, is simply not supported by the evidence in this record and is simply not true. And finally, when they say that after getting their certificate of authority from the commissioner, they formed a corporation and started selling life insurance, that is absolutely not true either, because as I said, they were chartered in 1852. Now, this case obviously does turn on statutory construction and construction of the rules of the State Board of Insurance. And the reason I did want to get to those rules is because there is a rule that the petitioners will not talk about in this entire proceeding. Let me say that they have cited Rule 1.28, and they argued that in the courts below. And in this case, with regard to Rule 1.28, they say at page 4 of their application, Rule 1.28 is not applicable in this case. And it is not applicable because it is the one that they read part of about deposit in the U.S. mail of a registered or certified letter returning to be requested containing a notice is the thing that starts the timeline. It's uncontradicted in this case that notice was not given by registered or certified mail. And so if they are correct, they didn't need to file a motion for rehearing yet. they still don't need to file one because that, according to them, is what starts their time limit. But that's not the way that rule reads. That rule says that it shall constitute notice of the decision or order if the agency decides to send it that way. And that date of deposit is the date of the act, after which time begins to run, as provided in Rule 1.7. And if you read 1.7, it begins, unless otherwise required by law, in computing any period of time prescribed or allowed by these sections. And it's talking about sections of the rule, not by statute, but by these sections. Then it goes into the customary language about the last day of the act not being included, unless it's a Saturday, Sunday, or holiday, which is not involved in this case because their 15th day fell on a Wednesday. Now, 1.7 doesn't apply. 1.28 doesn't apply by their own admission. 1.7 does say, unless otherwise required by law, they never will talk about Rule 1.9. It says, requirements and time limitations for a motion for rehearing in a contested case before the board is governed by the Act, Section 16. And if you look at 16E, it says, motions for rehearing must be filed within 15 days, not of notice, not of a telephone call, not of service, not of a contact on the street, not of a letter, certified, registered, or otherwise.
Rendition of a final judgment, whether you know it or not.
Rendition.
But this is, can't you see the danger by your reading this, that a lot of litigants can lose their rank because nobody, they didn't have notice, and nobody gave them the fairness of giving them notice so they could do whatever they want to do to preserve the right to appeal.
Your Honor, the danger I see in that situation is measured directly by the number of cases that have come to this court in which a motion for rehearing was not filed within 15 days. And this court, on two or three occasions, has had absolutely no problem in holding the requirements are jurisdictional, and as a matter of fact, in the opinion...
They are, if you have notice.
We do not know...
But the fundamental, you're trying to get the cart before the horse here.
We don't know how they got notice.
But they had notice. I mean, the notice is the basis of a rule that if you don't meet the jurisdiction requirements, you're out.
You talk about the danger. Again, all I can say is the number of cases in which this court has held that... And it has held it on, of course, repeated occasions. Petitioners do not suggest, have never contended, that Rule 1.49 is not a valid rule, and this court has held on countless occasions that an agency rule that is proper and valid has the full force and effect of the statute. So it's a question of them not wanting to adhere to the statute, the pattern, the procedure that the legislature set up, and the clear rule of the State Board of Insurance before which they were practicing.
But let me ask you, as a matter of course, do lawyers usually leave when they get in on these cases, they just leave a letter requesting a notice of any of the board's action along with a stamped envelope addressed to your law firm?
All I know is some don't get it in there. Maybe it's time we changed the administrative law completely. Maybe it's time this court wrote the statute to say that instead of that the notification is mandatory and that until every party to the administrative proceeding actually receives notice, the time doesn't start running on a motion for rehearing. There's a bill in the legislature that would do approximately that to the dismay of every agency that says it does other things also. But those were all things that the legislature could have done. Now, I'm trying to look at what they did do and what the practical results have been in this state for 20 years.
How long does it take some of these agencies to rule?
I personal experience, I suppose, the longest I've ever waited for a decision has been 6 months or so. If not, say it might have been some longer. Can enter the final decision? Usually that's preceded, as these cases were, by briefing, by sometimes oral arguments, such as here, and then a vote in open session, such as took place here. And, of course, it
my humble view that anyone that is aware of that or should be aware of it knows what's happening at the agency and better take steps to stay up with it and get a copy of that order.
Should we apply the same rule to district courts? You have a certain time to file a motion for new trial, a certain time to appeal. Can the court just simply render its decision, or this court, not notify any of the parties, and then say, sorry, your time limit for appealing is gone?
I think the rule you could apply in district courts is Rule 306A, which the court has listened with great specificity concerning district court orders or judgments of that reason. As to this court, I'm going to know when the decision comes down, and while I'd like to say the petitioner will be filing a motion for the hearing, if it's me, I'll have it in within the 15 days.
How are you going to know if we don't send
you? We're not going to tell you when we rule on this.
I'm going to come up and check the sheets every week.
We may not take it. We may not put it on the sheets.
If you make or decide among you as an affirmative act of this court to hide that fact and not publish it as you do with other cases, then I'll make outcry somewhere else. But I don't think you will. No. And I don't think agencies do, and I don't think there's a suggestion that that happened in this record. What I do say to you is I kept waiting or one of the petitioners, or some of them, to take the stand in the district court and say, I never got it. I never knew about it. I wasn't at the November 7 meeting. I didn't know the board acted. And I'm still waiting. If there are no other questions, that concludes our argument, and we respectfully pray that the opinions of, and decisions of the Court of Appeals and the trial court will be affirmed. I did not let you. The constitutional point, I would have to say it's handled exactly correctly by the Court of Appeals. The plaintiff's petitioner contends it has a property right in a name, the use of which has been denied to it by the State Board of Insurance, and which it now tells this court it has continued to use in defiance of that order that it says it is nullified. I think your argument is without merit. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Counselor, what's your response to his last point that you've never proved you didn't get notice?
Well, I was going to get to that, Your Honor, because I think that's the very point we need to address. The fact of the matter is, I think that when we talk about correcting the record, saying what the record really says, let's look at the statement of facts of what did occur in the trial court, and I think you're going to find that the trial court statement of facts is going to show that the evidence is that no notice was ever sent out by the State Board of Insurance. I was specifically asked by the court, I wasn't under oath, but I was specifically asked by the court if I had gotten notice, and I told the court no, but my client had never gotten notice. And what's more, I was asked by the court if I was present at the November meeting of the State Board of Insurance, and I informed the court that I was not, because we had not gotten notice of that meeting of the State Board of Insurance in November. The fact of the matter is that the record below, the record at the trial court level, reflects that there was not notice sent out by the State Board of Insurance.
Have you gotten notice yet for this?
No, sir. We have not gotten notice to this day. And that's my whole point. The whole point is one of fairness. How can you exercise a right if a party to the litigation controls whether or not you can exercise it?
If we agree with you on that point and we're trying to interpret Section 16 fairly, what do you say is a fair interpretation of it? Is it depositing it in the mail? Is it a receipt? What should be the appropriate interpretation of Section 16?
This is obviously me. An appropriate interpretation of Section 16 is that notice runs, the 15-day period of time runs from the date of either deposit in the mail or the date of actual notice through evidence and testimony. The date of that actual notice. And the evidence and testimony at the trial court level is that there was never any notice. That's what this court has been finding.
Somebody from the agency testified to that?
Yes,
that they never sent out any notice?
Yes, sir. The record of the agency was there.
As a fine point, do you mean the earlier?
Sir?
Do you mean the earlier of date of deposit in the mail or actual notice?
I mean the earlier of either one. 15 days run from the date you deposited in the mail or the date that you actually have notice. But the fact of the matter is that you can't exercise a right unless you have the ability to exercise it. The right is meaningless if somebody forecloses you from exercising that right. And furthermore, let's talk about, I keep hearing this thing about how we won't talk about Section 1.49 of the Board's rules. Well, Section 1.49 of the Board Rules simply says, requirements and time limitations for a motion for rehearing in a contested case before the commissioner, fire marshal, and the board is governed by Section 16 of the Act. What in that says that the 15 days runs? Nothing. The question is, how do you interpret Section 16? Not a sentence. Not a paragraph of a paragraph either. Not the sentence that says 15 days. It doesn't say that. It says in accordance with Section 16.
Mr. Leon, what about the implication or statement that we would not be here today if you had done what other lawyers that handle administrative matters do, and that is they request copies of the decision, and you did not do that, and that's where we have a problem.
Well, Your Honor, I guess that Ms. McCullough and I have different experiences before state agencies. That's all that I can say. I was general counsel of the State Board of Insurance in the mid-70s, and I've been practicing before that state agency since July 1, 1977. And I've never made it a practice to file a written notice requesting a written copy of the order of the board because it wasn't necessary. My experience before the State Board of Insurance is that they complied with Section 1.28 of their own rule. That is to say, they routinely sent out by certified mail return receipt requested copies of notices of the same and decisions and orders. That is just a matter of practice before the State Board of Insurance. And what's more, the implication of Section 1.28 is, again, permissive in the sense that the agency can decide to do it that way. I want you to read 1.28 as you have it in the statement of facts. If you find anything in Section 1.28 that says that the insurance board can provide notice by deposit in the mail if it chooses to do so, that's not what it says. It says that deposit in the U.S. mail constitutes notice. That's what it says, and that's all that it says. There's nothing in there about permissive at all. Now, I will tell you this. Ever since Ted Lowry let me know what the rules are for Ted Lowry, I made the practice to file a report. Simply says that if I want a copy of it, I've got to make a written request for it. But it doesn't say when the state agency has got to give it to me. So I figure, in order that we not have any more discussions about what the court could do, may do, should do, I'll go ahead and I'll say I want it within 5 days so I can exercise my right, presuming that Judge Lowry and the Austin Board of Appeals are correct.
But your experience since at least 1977 is that both the notice of the hearing and then the notice of the order goes out by certified mail return receipt requested.
Yes, sir.
And your evidence at the trial court in this case was that neither one was received by your people.
That's correct.
Did you put evidence on of this custom in practice?
No, sir, we did not. I can tell you that we did not do.
Proper public notice of the hearing was given, I take it.
Proper notice was given of the settings of hearing on the merits before the State Board of Insurance in January, then the resettings a couple of times, and of the final setting in July of 1984.
And if you've been at the public hearing, you would have heard the decision announced?
Well, now, they gave me notice of that by certified mail. They didn't give me notice of the meeting in November by certified mail. The only notice of the meeting in November where the decision was announced was in the Texas Register.
But it
was and that's right, if I'd been paying attention to the Texas Register and if I'd been following it, yes, sir, I would have gotten notice and I could have been there to hear them announce the decision. But that wouldn't have cured my problem. Because the 15 days for the date of filing the motion for rehearing does not run from the date they announce the decision. It runs from the date they render the decision. And the decision was not rendered until January 29th. Of 1985. So even if I'd been there, let's presume for a moment I was there. What good did that do me? Didn't do me any good. So the critical question.
What did they do at the November meeting?
What they did is the three board members in public session took up the question of the appeal from the order of the Commissioner of Insurance filed by these parties. And then somebody made a motion that we reversed the Commissioner of Insurance. It was voted on, and that's what was done.
Right. Was that the only item on the board's agenda?
No, there were several items. That wasn't the only item. That's simply one of the items taken up at that public meeting.
Was it listed on the board's agenda?
Oh, yes, sir.
That this, among other things, yes, was considered by the board?
Yes, sir.
And they announced that they what their decision was, but they didn't render it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir. They announced it, but they didn't render it in the sense that there was no written order. And the date runs, I don't think it's really dispute, but the date runs from January 29th, 1985, the date that the written order was signed and entered. That's when they rendered their decision. And we never got notice of that, and that is on the record.
But you knew sometime between November 7th and January 29th what they had done.
No, sir.
You never heard?
Never heard. I was not aware that the board had announced or rendered a decision until February 15th of 1985. And on February 15th of 1985, I immediately secured a copy of the order, and I immediately prepared the motion for rehearing and filed it.
Do I understand, counsel, that during the time that you were general counsel there, that they did give these notices after they had been, an order had been entered by the commission?
Oh, yes, sir. That was our practice.
Do you know whether or not that's still the policy?
I believe that's still the practice today. That's been my experience.
Have you had other matters since this came up where you did receive certified mail?
Yes, sir. I get them routinely.
That's final, a certified notice of final order.
Without request.
Without request. Never have had a request.
Does the record at trial court level reflect any reason why notice did not go out in this case?
No. All it reflects is that notice did not go out by certified mail. Notice did not come out. And again, I think that the court simply follows the decision that it rendered in Doctors Hospital Facility versus Fifth Court of Appeals. The result would be the same.
If I recall, that was not a statutory construction case.
No, sir, that was not. I'm talking about the principle that, I'm sorry.
The rationale. All right.
I'm sorry, I just asked you to reverse court approval. Thank you.
Any questions? Foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. That concludes the business of the court for today, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned. Subject to call.